Yeah, what's up? Dr. Swole here, MD, pro physique athlete. Today I'm joined by Dr. Pak, who is a coach at Stronger by Science. He's a PhD and researcher in strength and hypertrophy. He's also the chief editor of the Reps Research Review. Today we're going to be talking about some really interesting topics that Pak's been involved in terms of minimalist training, as well as some other useful things for us as competitors in physique and strength sport. Thanks for being on the show, Pak.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And yeah, I'm glad we finally managed to find the time to do this.
Yeah. So we're going to start off by talking about some of the research and applications of minimalist training. This is something that Dr. Pak's been involved in on the research end extensively. And I think it's going to be really useful for people to understand, particularly for people who are short on time, which I think is most of us. And, you know, even people just getting into lifting and not having to have that huge commitment necessarily of feeling like they need to be in the gym for 3 hours every day. So yeah, I was thinking, Dr. Pak, if you could just start off maybe with a very brief overview of the research we have so far.
For sure. So I specifically did my PhD on the minimum dose required to increase one repetition maximum strength in power lifters specifically. But because the available literature on powerlifters is quite limited, I had to look at the available literature on resistance trained individuals, where we essentially saw, and I reran the search for the inclusion criteria that we had set for our literature review back in 2020. I reran that a year and a half ago or so, and not much more had come out. And what we essentially found is that less than a handful of sets per lift per week, so 1 to 3 sets performed 2 to 3 times per week at around, let's say, 70 to 85% of 1 RM, but let's express this in as a rep range, so around 6 to 12 reps for roughly 0 to 2 RIR, that was enough to induce statistically significant one repetition maximum strength increases in resistance trained individuals. Then we also did a bunch of intervention studies where we actually took power lifters and had them do extremely low volume training. So like some groups were going as low as performing one single repetition, so one near max rep per week for the deadlift, while doing like a couple of reps per week for the squat and 3 reps per week for the bench. And we had powerlifters do a bunch of different low volume training protocols and saw that for a powerlifter who's looking at gaining a meaningful amount of strength, 3 to 6 sets at around 1 to 5 reps per lift per week, close to RPE 7.5 to 9.5, seem to be more than enough to actually lead to meaningful strength increases. And we determine meaningfulness by actually speaking to coaches and athletes and asking them what sort of changes they regard as meaningful. And then we compared their responses to data from openpowerlifting.org and what is required for one to move up one place in the rankings, just so we establish we have a better definition of meaningfulness. Because in our field, and like in the strength and physique world, meaningfulness and the definition of meaningfulness can vary. And I think that sometimes clouds one's ability, or at least influences one's ability to really differentiate between optimal on paper and like suboptimal, but still meaningful. And that's something I'll touch on in a sec. As far as hypertrophy goes, from the current literature, we see that you can make really solid gains. So the majority of your gains with like 4 to 9 sets per muscle group per week, you could go as low as 1 to 4, but then you're looking maybe at like roughly 60% of potential gains, but you could get up to 80% of your potential gains with like 5 to 9 hard sets per muscle group per week. And that's if you only look at direct sets per muscle group per week. Actually, yeah, if you then take in consideration that, you know, your biceps are getting some work from your lats and so on and so forth, then if you're approaching your training with a 5 to 9 sets per week sort of a volume prescription, you could actually be getting in many more sets and being in that quote-unquote optimal optimal range. The thing is that if we then take a small step back and look at Gen Pop and the data on Gen Pop, there was a study we did led by Dr. Steele, shout out to James, where we had access to the data from a gym chain in the Netherlands called Fit20. And essentially that chain's business model is that they cater to very busy individuals and they train them for 20 minutes per week. And that's all they do. They do like 4 to 6 exercises, they do around 5 to 6 exercises, one set on each exercise at 4 to 6 reps per set, performed to momentary failure. So to the point where they're unable to perform another repetition. And with just 20 minutes per week, so we had access to, just give me 1 second. Did my sound change at all?
No, it's okay.
Perfect. So we had access to over 15,000 individuals worth of data and for over 7 years. And with just 20 minutes per week, they were able to increase their strength around 50 to 60% over baseline for the first year or two. And then they sort of maintained that while it was still training up, but it somewhat plateaued. But we're talking about like mostly individuals around their 50s. So I took a slight step away from strength and physique sports to show that for the average individual, making strength and muscle gains to a certain extent that could still be, you know, that could still improve their well-being and overall life quality, that could be achieved with even as low as 20 minutes per week, which I'm not recommending you go that low because there's other health benefits that you can get from resistance training. But things look pretty good, both for Gen Pop, Gen Pop individuals, but also for strength and physique athletes. You can get away with much less training than you may have previously thought, and still make meaningful gains, although suboptimal.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful to understand, especially when people feel like that there's this barrier between them and getting a good physique, where you either need to be this hardcore bodybuilder or just not lifting at all. And understanding that you can capture a lot of your gains with those initial few sets, you know, especially if you have an idea of how to program that. So I want to get a bit more into the nitty-gritty of the strength side of the research. So for those protocols, what exactly were people doing?
Sure. So we had one group, which we repeated over a couple of studies, that was just doing heavy singles at RP 9 to 9.5. No back offsets, no accessories, no anything else. They were doing, they were following a 2-3-1 squat bench deadlift weekly frequency, where they were squatting twice a week, benching 3 times per week, and deadlifting once per week. Now, they trained 3 times per week, obviously. So they trained day one, break, day two, break, day three. And in our first study, we looked at that group versus the exact same configuration, but with the addition of 2 triples at 80% of whatever they hit for the single. So they would go in, work up to a heavy single, take 80% of whatever they hit, because that was their daily max, because it was near RP10, and then they performed a couple of triples. And the way we looked at their... Actually, before I get into the results, there was also another group that we compared in another study versus the group doing the back offsets again. And that group did AMRAPs using 70% of their pre-test 1 repetition maximum. So before the study, everybody got tested. Mm-hmm. And that group just took 70% of their 1RM and performed a high repetition AMRAP at RP 9 to 9.5.
Okay, awesome. And then in terms of the actual effect sizes, how much strength were these guys gaining?
So the way we actually looked at strength increases, we took a slightly different approach than you normally see in the literature. And we essentially, again, spoke with coaches and athletes. So we surveyed 140-ish strength powerlifting athletes and coaches to see what they regard as a meaningful change over 6 weeks. And that's something I forgot to mention. These protocols were 6 weeks long. And we essentially asked them, hey, what do you think is a meaningful increase, strength increase over that period of time? And then we calculated the probability that by following that sort of training, what's the probability of you achieving strength increases that are within what the coaches and athletes regard as a meaningful increase, or above or below? And so I'll just talk about total strength, so we don't spend way too much time going over each individual lift. But the group that did just the single, so we're talking like really, really low volume training, right? So again, for the deadlift, that would be one rep for the whole week. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, some warm-up sets as well, but your whole training week would be you going to the gym and doing one repetition on the deadlift. Mm-hmm. So the group that did that had a 6% chance of achieving strength increases as far as powerlifting total strength, SBD combined. They had a 6% chance of achieving increases greater than what the coaches and athletes regarded as meaningful, but they had a 13% chance of being within what the athletes and coaches regarded as meaningful. That said, the group that added just two back of sets of three repetitions at 80% of their single, so nothing too crazy, right? We're not talking about insanely high RP sets or insanely time-consuming sets, but that group had a 99% chance of achieving gains greater than what the coaches and athletes regard as meaningful. Now, I'll give you some numbers as well to put those in perspective. The max group gained, on average, around 11 kilos on their total. That would be, 22, 25 pounds, something along those lines. You're the real doctor here. I expect you to be able to calculate that on the fly. I'm just just a mere academic. But joking aside, the max and back of group, so the group that did the back of sets, they saw an average of around 30 kilos increase on their total. Now, take those numbers with a grain of salt. Some people saw greater strength increases than others. And at the same time, it's important to not view these strength increases as absolute all-time PRs. Because if I was to take you today and say, hey, want to take part in our study, rest for a few days, let's get you tested. Sure, you'd be able to hit a solid 1RM, but then after a few weeks of very specific 1RM strength training, you may hit a PR that is greater than that pre-test 1RM, but that may not necessarily represent an all-time PR for you, which doesn't take everything away from the study, but it's a limitation that we need to take in account, right? It's important to express these results with caution. And as far as the second study, and this is all part of one paper, we published it as a multi-experiment paper. And we also had interviews with extremely high-level coaches and athletes. I'm talking elite-level athletes, including all-time world record holders, multiple IPF world champions, as well as coaches of that caliber that had worked with thousands of athletes. So what we did is we triangulated qualitative. We took a mixed methods approach where we interviewed experts and we did some studies so that we can see how those two align together. Because having a couple of studies on the topic with just a few powerlifters. So we had 16 powerlifters in the study I mentioned. And the second study, because of the pandemic, data collection was cut short. So we only had 9 participants total. But at the same time, being able to compare with what the coaches and athletes said allowed us to have a more holistic view, as well as explore the concept of the minimum dose in general. So in the second study, we had the group that performed AMRAPs using 70% of their 1RM, and that group performed much more training volume in the form of multiple repetition sets than the group that had previously performed just singles. So the group that did the AMRAPs had a 40% chance of achieving strength increases greater than what the coaches and athletes regarded as meaningful, while they had a 26% chance of being within what they regarded as meaningful. But we compared the AMRAP group again with another max plus back offset group, so a group that did a single and back offsets. And again, we saw that the group that did the singles and back offsets achieved had a 98% chance of achieving strength increases greater than what the athletes and coaches had regarded as meaningful. So the AMRAP group gained about 15 kilos on their total. The Max and Backoff group gained about 26 kilos on their total, again, with the previous disclaimers baked in as well.
Yeah, that's really cool to hear. I think that it's quite striking, like hearing how like the 99%, you know, that's a lot. And, you know, considering that these are people who have trained before as well, it's like a lot of strength and conditioning research is done in ranked beginners, and is you have to take it in context. In terms of, you know, your recommendations, what are your recommendations for people in terms of programming? Let's say they want to build both strength and hypertrophy in terms of like a minimalistic approach.
For sure. So I would say that given the current state of the literature and the latest meta-analysis and series of meta-regressions that came out on the effect of proximity to failure on hypertrophy and strength, I would say that if you're pressed for time and you want to sort of approach both training for hypertrophy and strength and want to see gains that are meaningful and want to maximize your chances of those gains being meaningful while still maximizing time efficiency, obviously one way would be to go full on minimum dose and do just 1 to 3 single repetitions per lift per week and 1 to 3 sets per muscle group per week to failure, and combine those for a hybrid strength and hypertrophy approach. But the chances of you achieving meaningful gains there are lower than if you were to do a bit more. And what you could do is do singles and back-off sets for the lifts that you want to particularly get stronger on. So let's say you want to get stronger on the squat. You could have singles and back-off sets on that, around 3 to 6 sets per week, where you're not going to failure, but you're still relatively close to failure because you're using a heavier load. So one could make the argument that those sets will have some thumbs up effect on hypertrophy, some positive effect on hypertrophy as well. And then you do somewhere between 5 to 8 sets per muscle group per week for hypertrophy in the 5 to 30 rep range. But I'd say for time efficiency's sake, being around the 5 to 12 rep range would be ideal, where you do take those sets to momentary muscular failure. So to the point where you're unable to perform another repetition despite attempting to do so. And that would not only allow you to be very time efficient, but it would also maximize your chances of achieving meaningful gains within the context of minimalist training. And even though 5 to 8 may sound like it's something, like it's not a lot, but it sounds like a significant amount, at least. Like if we break it down, you're talking about like a few sets per muscle group divided by a couple of sessions. So it could be like 3 sets on one day, 3 sets on another day, and then 2 sets on another day, which is definitely manageable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there's a lot more that people can accomplish in a short amount of time than they think. And in terms of, you know, the more advanced audience, obviously there's a lot of people who are going to be listening to this who want more than just minimal or, you know, minimal progress. How should you go about titrating your volumes if you wanted to optimize things more? Like, for example, if you felt that you might need more volume, how would you go about figuring that out and landing on the right amount?
Yeah, so obviously for more advanced individuals who are, you know, physique or strength athletes, obviously there's a different relationship between training volume and hypertrophy versus strength. But like if you are a bodybuilder and you are committed to your sport, it makes sense that you will try to get as much as you can out of your training whenever you can, right? And that's why I mentioned meaningfulness and the definition of meaningfulness. What's meaningful for you, for the average gym goer who just wants to be jacked and strong, may not be meaningful because they don't care about their bicep looking slightly bigger under the right type of light because they're not competing at a very high level like you are. But for the individuals that are interested in maximizing their gains, what I would say is if time availability allows for them especially when training for muscle growth and when being in a gaining phase. If time availability allows for them to add a few more sets, adding a few more sets over time and being closer to the 10 to 20 sets per muscle group per week makes sense. Now, aside from time, we must also consider recovery resources, and stress as well. So a lot of us, including yourself, you're somebody who has a demanding job, and there will be weeks where you may not be able to sleep as well, or your sleep schedule will be off. On those weeks, trading off, so forcing more training volume and getting more fatigue out of it, especially given the latest data that came out on training close to failure, sometimes even being more important than training volume. I'd say if you're close to around 10 sets per muscle group per week, even slightly below that, especially for short periods of time, I would bet on this that it is unlikely you're going to be seeing any less progress than if you were doing more volume, at least in the short term. Now, if you can add more training volume and you feel like you're recovering well and you have more time, then sure, being in that 10 to 20 range and adjusting accordingly makes sense. But if you're pressed for time and you want to still keep making progress, I'm confident in saying that, you know, 8 really hard sets close to or to failure per week, per muscle group per week, even for a physique athlete, that is under time pressure and maybe under more stress than usual, I think those would be more than enough for them to see meaningful progress. At the same time, it is important to understand that how are we really evaluating progress at that level? It's not like you're going to be gaining slabs of muscle in 8 weeks, or you're going to be looking at your physique after 3 weeks of training with a minimalist approach because you're very busy at work and you will be able to notice any difference. So buying into the idea that, okay, low volume training has worked anecdotally for a lot of people, there's data to show that you can make substantial strength and hypertrophy increases with that training, and you're not really doing that low volume, like your approach is not that low in volume as some people think, and you're much closer to what's optimal than it may appear. So having all those factors sort of in front of you, and those facts as well, and buying into and placeboing, for lack of a better term, yourself into the fact that this training is still worth doing and that you shouldn't be forcing the higher volume training because you can't recover from it, I think that will help a lot of people, one, be consistent, and in the long term, make as good gains as they would have if they were forcing, or even better gains, as if they were forcing volume where volume couldn't be forced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whenever possible, I recommend people try and go for a more minimalistic approach, because I'd rather you have some slack in your life and be able to stay consistent in the long term, rather than always being riding on the edge of what you're able to fit into your schedule. From the strength aspect, let's say someone is following a relatively minimalistic approach, or say more of that top set back off method, and they want to start off with a protocol like what people were using in the research. What would be the next step in terms of adding more volume if they felt that they needed to change things up?
That's an awesome question, and just to let everyone know, I have made a few free templates that reflect, they're slightly modified, that reflect what we used in the studies, and if you go to minimumdosetraining.com, there's a link for the spreadsheets. They're completely free, and you can have a look at them. There's obviously guidance on how to adjust them, and so on and so forth, but what I would say is that the first step would be to run these templates or take that approach, a similar approach to what we did in the studies, for like 6 to 8 weeks, take a couple of days off or like 5 days off like the participants did, test your strength, see how you're feeling, potentially run those again. But I would say it makes sense, unless you're absolutely trying to minimize time, that you include some accessory work in there and some supplemental hypertrophy work, unless you're purely focusing on SBD one-arm strength. It would be good to include some direct, you know, lat work, maybe a bit more leg, arm, chest, shoulder, a bit more hypertrophy work overall in the form of like single sets, close to failure. But if you're just solely focusing on strength and care just about SBD strength, and you do 6 to 8 weeks of any of those protocols, you see great gains. And then you repeat it and things are feeling kind of stale, or it's not feeling like you're getting much out of it, I would recommend that you start adding maybe an extra single in the form of a back of single, maybe adding another back of triple, and then potentially considering adding a bit of accessory work as well. So for the squat, you could be doing a secondary squat movement, but just slowly drip fitting more volume in, because although the relationship between volume and strength is different to that of volume and hypertrophy, there are cases where more volume, even in our studies, more volume was better. So even though the two triples added to the back of added in the back of group don't seem like much, when expressed as a percentage, they do represent a 600% increase in training volume. Mm-hmm. So they actually got much more out of doing much more volume. So yeah, drip feeding a bit more volume in the form of extra back of sets and back of singles or triples, and then adding some accessories could be a way to go about this while still keeping things really time efficient, and then essentially milking the extra volume that you're adding. So adding a couple of extra sets per week per lift may allow you to get another productive 6 weeks where you still see your strength go up, and then you can add a bit more, and then you can add a bit more, and maybe you can keep going for some time. Obviously it depends on individual circumstances and as well as goals, right? Because hypertrophy may be important for strength in the long term as well. So there will come a point where, like, if you're a very proficient lifter, it may be that, hey, it's time that you gain some body weight and you focus on hypertrophy training so that you can get stronger in the long term. So there will come a point, in my opinion, where you'll need to do more. Now, more doesn't mean all of the volume, but it means that, hey, perhaps you will be able to run this successfully for a few months and then call it a day. Do I think that if you said, hey, I will do this for the rest of my life, do I think that you'd be seeing bad results? Not necessarily. You'd most definitely see some gains and then maintain those gains, in my opinion. But realistically speaking, it would become very, very boring and potentially tiring in other ways, because like doing heavy singles every week, like imagine yourself doing that for 6 months straight. Some people have done it, but a lot of people can't really have fun with that.
Yeah, that's well said. And I think there is going to be a role for, you know, mixing up your training, particularly with some of those indirect features, as you mentioned, in terms of the mental side of it, as well as, you know, things with your connective tissues and some the importance of hypertrophy for strength as well. Out of curiosity, what do we have on the maintenance volume required to hold on to strength? Like, what is the minimum dose for just maintaining strength?
So as far as one repetition maximum strength goes, based on our, like, there's one specific study that looked at maintaining strength specifically, but based on our studies, you could go as low as like a heavy rep per week, and you'll maintain strength. A heavy single per week per lift, and chances are you're going to be maintaining strength, if not slightly increasing it. So maintenance volumes for 1RM strength specifically are very low. And for general strength, if we're going to call it general strength, you're going to the gym and doing every lift that you usually do and doing just a set of that lift at like, let's say 3 to 10 reps, but going to failure, it is very unlikely that you're going to be losing any strength. And again, you may actually see a slight temporary strength increase simply because all of a sudden you're doing much less, but you're still doing enough so that you're not as fatigued, but now you are more fresh and you're lifting heavier and so on and so forth. But for strength, I would prioritize heavier loads versus higher repetition sets. And I would argue that although our meta-analysis found, because that was the literature available, that, you know, sets of 6 to 12 repetitions performed close to or to momentary failure were enough, so a few sets per week, like less than a handful sets per lift per week, were enough for people to make significant strength gains based on the latest meta-analysis by Robinson et al., I would be confident in saying that you'd probably be able to get away with those sets being much further away from failure than they were, because the studies that made it in our systematic review and meta-analysis were not designed necessarily to optimize 1RM strength, nor were they informed by the literature, which obviously has changed since then. So you doing a set of five reps at RPE 4 or 5, a couple of times per week, moved with maximal intent, maybe more than enough to maintain your strength. Although, if you're interested in both strength and hypertrophy, might as well take that set to failure. And you know from the data that strength is going to be fine, hypertrophy will be fine as well. And overall, everybody's happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome. I think it's really valuable to, chat about this kind of stuff, where I was like thinking about, looking at extremes, where what's kind of on the minimum end of things where people are doing and getting results, and then kind of on the maximum end, and it really benchmarks what is realistic and what you can get away with, kind of thing. Switching gears now, I want to talk a bit more about some of the other research you've involved in. There's a paper you were on, which was a systematic review of case studies on physique competitors, and mm-hmm. wanted to ask about some of your findings there. So could you tell us briefly about that paper?
For sure. It was a collaborative paper with, it was led actually by Dr. Schoenfeld. So a huge shout out to him. He is the head of our lab, and
the goat.
The goat indeed. And there were plenty of other individuals to shout out. So plenty of other people from our lab, including Alec Pinero, Ryan Burke, Max Coleman, Adam Mohan, as well as other no names in the evidence-based strength and hypertrophy field, like Guillermo Escalante, Bill Campbell, Eric Helms, and Alexa Rukstella. So I think I did a good job at pronouncing the name. And I shouted out all the authors. And this paper is called Alterations in Measures of Body Composition, Neuromuscular Performance, Hormonal Levels, Physiological Adaptations, and Psychometric Outcomes During Preparation for Physique Competition. Essentially looking at the effect of bodybuilding comp prep on one's strength, body composition, and so on and so forth. This was, obviously, it's important to put this out there, although this was a systematic review. It was a systematic review of case studies. And now that doesn't mean that it is nothing to pay attention to, but we did look at just a handful of, not a handful, but like just a few individuals, because we did look at case studies, because it's very difficult to carry out long-term studies on competitive bodybuilders. Now, some of the cliff notes were that female athletes tend to preserve more lean mass. Hormones like cortisol, testosterone, and testosterone were affected negatively. So was absolute power. But when looking at power relative to body weight, that was maintained. So it remained similar in most competitors. Some people actually saw increases in some measures of absolute strength. So obviously each case study assessed, some case studies at least assessed strength differently. Like there were studies that looked at grip strength, others looked at 1RM strength, others looked at isometric strength, and so on and so forth. But we saw like a decrease. For example, one study tested 1RM strength, and although the absolute strength of the individuals decreased by quite a bit, their relative strength to their body weight remained somewhat similar or increased in some cases, which was very interesting for myself. Things like resting metabolic rate, blood pressure, and heart rates decreased. There was a report of menstrual cycle changes and even loss in some female competitors. But, and I found this interesting, there were no reports of eating behaviors that met the threshold for eating disorders in many of the individuals in the case studies. And it's important to know that the case studies were all on drug-free, either tested or self-reported drug-free individuals. So the main takeaway, obviously, like this is not one of those papers where it dramatically influences practice. So even for you as a bodybuilder, I doubt you saw that and you were like, okay, now my approach to comp prep has completely changed. But I do think that it highlights the fact that natural bodybuilding is can have some temporary deleterious effects on health, but it may not be as nearly as bad as people have presented bodybuilding in general to be, looking at the enhanced side, which also involves heavy PED use and sometimes insane drying out and water manipulation protocols and other extreme practices. And what we saw is, yes, sure, things became quite rough towards the end. And because we did the coding, so I was part of the coding team. Shout out the rest of the team. Shout out Alec and Adam. We actually looked at all the data for each different time point, you know, on each study. And things were getting worse towards the last few weeks as far as, you know, decreases in strength and so on and so forth. But, I mean, that's to be somewhat expected. Things got rough towards the end, but it wasn't like these people were ready to, you know, it's not like they destroyed their physiques, their strength and health towards the end of the prep. It's that things got rough, and that was about it. But in my opinion, the fact that we didn't see relative decreases in power and strength, which was part of the manuscript I focused on, I personally found that quite interesting, especially when looking at 1RM strength. So, you know, you prepping for a comp, you see your squat go down by 20 kilos. And, you know, some people will see that and be like, oh, yeah, yeah, my strength out of the window. But then if you consider the fact that you're also 15 kilos lighter, you've actually maintained your strength while being at an insanely low body fat percentage, which I think is interesting. And I think natural bodybuilding may have been carrying a bit worse of a rep than it should be based on, you know, some of the freak show accidents or freak show practices that we see in enhanced bodybuilding.
I think that's really motivating. I think particularly what you said about looking at relative strength losses where, yeah, as you said, it's really demotivating when you see your numbers going down in prep and, you know, people feel like everything's falling off the rails. But if you actually proportion it to your body weight and you look at your relative strength, if it's preserved, I think that's actually very reassuring. And it makes sense that, you know, you're losing mass and that's going to affect your numbers. In terms of the actual measures of strength, you said that for some, the strength actually increased. Which ones were those?
That was, if I'm not mistaken, it was isometric leg extension strength, grip strength, and let me just have a quick look. Those two for sure, but I know that 1RM strength decreased, and I am not buying myself time by...
Yeah, because one thing I wonder about is that when you look at strength, I think for certain movements, particularly something like a squat or a bench, I think that as you go through prep, there are going to be multiple factors that are going to be contributing to strength loss in that sense, where I think like some of it would be, for example, leverages, like when you are just are not as big, you don't have as much bracing out of the hole in the squat. With a bench, you actually have an slightly increased range of motion, where I almost wonder if, you know, something like a more isolation type movement might be less affected by those factors.
Yeah, and I think that's something that people discount heavily. But to your point, so athletes in two of the included studies, they expressed absolute strength increases via hand grip and isometric knee extension. So it was actually those two. I remembered correctly. But in the other studies, as I said, where they assessed strength as the peak force during the squat exercise, there was one athlete that experienced an increase, like a female athlete, of up to 5%, while others increased, while others experienced decreases of 25% to 9%. But again, there were some competitors that saw some strength increases even in that measure, but the athletes in the two studies that looked at hand grip strength and isometric knee extension strength actually saw increases in strength. However, grip strength has been shown to not be affected much by weight loss. So even in other studies that looked at hand grip strength and weight loss, they saw that that doesn't have much of an effect. But at the same time, the fact that the relative one arm strength was the same or even slightly better in some, I think that was great, because the same way, like, that's why we have weight classes in powerlifting, and that's why you wouldn't look at your strength versus my strength, because I am fatter and bolder than you, and you know I shouldn't be allowed to be compared. I'm just now speaking without having anything to say, so I will say hey.
And then in terms of the hormone side, what did you guys find?
So I am reluctant to expand way too much on the hormonal side of things, because that wasn't under my area of expertise. But overall, I guess the main takeaway is that although there were some deleterious effects on hormones like testosterone, the effects were not as extreme as one would could potentially expect. And just to directly quote from the manuscript, if we look at let's say cortisol, so there was an increase in cortisol, but it was something that happened as the competitors were approaching their competition, and I guess that's to be expected. Now, in the 6 male athletes where testosterone was measured, again quoting, levels dropped in almost a linear fashion throughout the contest prep, and they actually increased in females or remained relatively stable over the course. But let me see. I wanted to mention that the baseline values. So actually, in the male athletes towards the end, testosterone did dip to pretty low levels, but that was mostly towards the end of their prep. Now, there were some studies that also reported on estrogen, and they looked at specifically 3 female athletes. But again, there was some variability there, and this was one of these areas where there's previous research to show that during weight loss, estrogen will decline. But there was no significant decline in estrogen, and maybe that's what contributed to the females losing less lean mass. I'm trying to be super cautious here, because we are talking about just a handful of individuals per hormone. So like, and I'm not sure exactly how much we can take from those findings and generalize them. Detail with strength, right? But yeah, that's I guess the gist of it.
Yeah, and in terms of the testosterone drop in the males, you said that it happened more so near the end. Did they have an idea of the time frame in terms of when it, you know, the steeper drops happened, or particularly what I'd want to know is like the body fat percentage they were at?
So I can't tell you off the top of my head. Obviously, there was a linear reduction. So as they were getting closer to comp, testosterone was dropping, was dropping lower and lower. But I don't remember off the top of my head whether, because other people asked that as well, and I remember one of the reviewers mentioned body fat levels specifically. But if we look at overall body composition changes, so the males lost fat a bit faster than the males. Males started, they ended roughly at around 6%. Body fat. So I guess the closer the lower you get below 10% body fat, the worse you should expect those effects to be on testosterone. If you want to give a very sort of cautious, generalizable statement. But again, we're just talking about a few athletes. So all male athletes competed at less than 10% body fat. So I guess saying below 10% body fat is where you'd expect to see decreases in testosterone that could be deleterious to your overall health. I'd say makes sense. However, this wasn't like one of those findings where I was like, oh wow, testosterone was pretty low towards the end of a natural bodybuilding prep. And I would still not say, oh yeah, do not compete because your testosterone will drop very low for the last few weeks, because it's likely that that will return back to baseline after you start regaining body fat and eating well and returning to a body composition that is healthier than being so lean.
Yeah, that's helpful to know. I think that it's always going to be really difficult in this kind of population, you know. Looking at myself, like, I wouldn't want anyone, you know, studying me or particularly trying to impose any intervention on my contest prep. So I think this is one of those areas of research where it's going to be really difficult to really figure out, like, what works and what doesn't necessarily for contest prep bodybuilders. But yeah, it's great to see that there's some research starting to come out.
Yeah, it was a great project, and it was a great collaborative effort, because obviously we had to break it down in different categories as well, and it was great to have people that were experts in each of those categories, each category, look at that and provide their intake, but not their intake, their input. I'm not sure. It's too much coffee, and especially at those weird times. Now, I do want to say, though, that it's cool to see more stuff come out on bodybuilding, even in the form of, you know, a systematic review on case studies. And I think this sort of collection of case studies does demonstrate that performing case studies still hold some value, because then we can take all those case studies and have, you know, a look at a population that we wouldn't be able to look at otherwise. So, you know, it may potentially push people to do more case studies on high level bodybuilders or competitive bodybuilders and powerlifters. And we're actually doing a case study on a powerlifter at the moment as well. But yeah, it's much easier to do a case study, much easier to tell you, hey, come to the lab before your comp, come to the lab mid-comp, come to the lab after your comp. We'll do a bunch of free tests. You get some insight. You don't need to change your training or your diet. Just let us know what you're doing. We'll look at you. And it's much easier to do that on a couple of individuals rather than trying to look at a bunch of bodybuilders, because it's unlikely that you'll be able to coordinate that sort of crowd.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So I just wanted to touch on one more paper that you were involved in, and that was on deloading. And paper was titled, "You Can't Shoot Another Bullet Until You've Reloaded the Gun: Coaches, Perceptions, Practices, and Experiences of Deloading in Strength and Physique Sports." You know, in general, I think deloading is a really tricky topic to talk about, because there are so many factors involved, and it depends a lot on individual, you know, robustness of the athlete, as well as your own training protocol. Like, I mean, we just talked about minimalistic training, and if you were someone who is a beginner and using a very, very like minimalistic training approach, you may not need much deloading at all. What was some of the spectrum of deloading practices that people were using?
Yeah, so this was the first study on deloads for strength and physique sports ever. And this the reason, and this was led by Lee Bell from Sheffield Hallam. Shout out to Lee. And the reason behind this study, behind conducting this study, the main sort of motivating factor was that deloads are one of those practices that are regarded as common knowledge, when in reality they're more common belief. So as far as like actual scientific evidence on deloads goes, we don't have much. We actually had nothing. We had a few training succession studies, but we could both argue that, you know, from a practical standpoint in the field, training succession is not what a deload necessarily looks like, at least sometimes, right? So the goal of this paper was to speak with very high level strength and physique coaches and see, hey, what do you guys do as far as deloading goes? What do you think a deload is? And the gist of this paper, and we are blessed to now have the first training intervention study of deloads by Coleman et al. It's currently under review, but it has been published as a preprint. But essentially the gist of the paper, because this was an interview study, right? So it was a qualitative piece of research, and it's not as easy as saying, hey, the X group gained X amount of strength and the group that didn't deload lost X amount of strength. So deloads are mostly used to dissipate both physiological and psychological fatigue. They're usually used week. Some people, when it comes to training frequency, will reduce training days that one is working out on. But the main thing that came out from the interviews was that training volume and intensity of effort will go down. Training volume is usually reduced by 30 to 50% of what you normally do. And that can be achieved by a plethora of different ways, either reducing reps per set, sets per week, and so on and so forth. At the same time, intensity of effort, so like let's say you're working close to failure, 0 to 2 RIR, that will probably have to be increased. So your proximity to failure will have to increase to, let's say, 4 to 5 reps in reserve, roughly. At the same time, some coaches also spoke about exercise selection and the fact that during a deload you can play around with new exercises just for enjoyment's sake and just for a mental break. However, you should be cautious with using exercises that may be way too different to what you're usually used to doing, because that could lead to a greater deal of fatigue. And at the same time, the main takeaway here was that if there's a reason for you to be pre-planning deloads, let's say you have an event coming up, or you have a very strict competitive schedule, or it's something that you've seen from experience works really well with you because you are a lifter who trains very hard, who can train very hard mentally for 5 weeks, but then you need a break, then that's fine. But in most cases, reactive deloads, and that's something that is further supported by the study that Max Coleman et al. Just published as a preprint, is that reactive deloads are probably the best way to approach deloading. So when training intensity, when you cannot hit the same training intensity, when performance starts regressing, when you're feeling really fatigued, and that happens for some time, so maybe like a couple of weeks in a row, that's probably a good sign that you need to deload. And reactively deloading may allow you to train harder for longer periods of time versus proactively deloading when you don't need it. And actually, Max's study showed that proactively deloading when not needed may actually lead to some negative effects as far as isometric and dynamic strength goes.
Yeah, briefly, what did they find in that paper? I've heard about it.
Yeah, so really well-run study. Shout out to Max. And again, first intervention study to look at deloads. So it was essentially two groups, 8 weeks. One group trained for 8 weeks straight. The other group did 4 weeks, then deload in the form of a week off, just because it made things easier from a logistical standpoint. And then another 4 weeks of training, hypertrophy of so quad and calf hypertrophy was assessed via ultrasound. There was a body composition assessment, dynamic strength via the use of a 1RM Smith squat test. Was also used. Isometric strength was assessed via leg extension, isometric leg extension on the IKD. And there was also a power assessment. And essentially, those groups performed about 20 sets per week per muscle group, well, for the quads and calves, via Smith squats, leg extensions, seated calf raises, and calf raises performed on the leg press. And they followed an unsupervised, so their training was supervised, but they also followed an unsupervised upper body training program. And what came out is that both groups made solid hypertrophy gains, but at the same time, the group that didn't deload experienced greater dynamic and isometric strength gains. And what was interesting is that the participants in the group that didn't deload, actually, the participants in the group that deloaded felt like they didn't need a deload, and also reported feeling somewhat tired or lethargic post deload week. And the fact that they didn't need to deload and they deloaded in the form of taking a week off kind of, again, highlights the fact that, hey, if you don't need a deload, probably not the best idea to take one. Mm-hmm. And what we saw is that the fact that they saw a negative effect on strength. So both groups gained the same amount of muscle, no difference there. But the group that didn't deload saw better strength gains. Now, I wouldn't take that and say, hey, deloads ruin your strength or affect your gains, but rather that taking a deload when you don't need it may temporarily affect your strength. Now, in reality, would you notice that strength change? I'm not sure, because they were tested. I don't know if it would translate to you going to the gym and feeling significantly weaker on a bunch of exercises, but that's just my take. But overall, it's the way I believe the study should be interpreted is that a week off the gym is not going to destroy your gains, especially from a hypertrophy standpoint. As far as strength goes, you're also, like, we do have other papers as well that have looked at training cessation and whether that has an effect on strength athlete strength, and even 3 or 5 days haven't done much to powerlifter strength. So overall, I would take this as the first study on deload that showed, hey, a week off the gym is not going to be the worst thing for your gains, and take a deload when you need it versus pre-planning it and taking it if you're when you don't need it and you still feel fresh.
Yeah, I like that, where I think it's another kind of data point to remind us that, you know, taking a week off isn't going to be the worst thing ever. And
yes,
I also like what you mentioned about saying that, you know, it's more about saying a deload may not be the best thing if you don't need it, where it's like you want to think about when you actually need one. And if you're really just trying to cheat a week off, where I think that, you know, the question I'm interested in is, in this study, basically people were running the same program, but in a more optimal sense, the question would be, what if I compared a short mesocycle where I had much more intense training versus a longer mesocycle with less intense training, where, you know, the deload was necessary at an earlier stage versus a later stage? But one of those things, I guess, we'll have to wait to see.
Yeah, and it, like, the guys did a pretty good job at actually, like, setting up a program that was quite hard. So we're talking about, like, 20 sets per muscle group per week. I was present for data collection. So, you know, there were participants that failed reps that went for that extra rep and didn't get it, obviously done safely. Everybody was encouraged to push their sets, and there were multiple researchers present. So the study did try to make training quite fatiguing, but I do think that, you know, you could be looking at, like, an even more extreme protocol where people, like, you're almost guaranteeing that they will feel like they need a deload. But as you know, many people don't realize, like, these types of studies, and we're talking about, like, 38 participants here, 50 recruited, 38 making it in the end. Like, these are studies that are very difficult to run. And yeah, ideally, we would have a long-term study with multiple deload configurations as well, and reactive deloading as well, where then we could be grouping. But logistically speaking, you would require a lot of funding to do that. And nobody's funding deload studies. I will, when I am a trillionaire, buy my NFT, which I haven't released yet, but please buy it, or just send me trillions. But joking aside, unless there's significant funding, it's going to be very difficult to see, like, a 24-week study on deloading, looking at exactly what we're doing in the field. And this is why it's important to also look at coaches and athletes and their practices too, because they can give us something, at least better, definitely more than nothing.
Yeah, so we're accepting some donations for deload funding. You can hit up Dr. Pack's PayPal link in the description below, and just transfer, minimum transfer is $1 million.
$1,000,000.
All right. So anyways, that was a great chat, man. I think that there's a lot of practical information that's starting to come out in the literature, and it's cool to hear updates on it. Where can people find you?
They can find me on Linktree. So linktr.ee/drpak. So Dr. Pack. And Instagram under dr_pack. So the other username iterations were not available. But Yeah, the first link has all my research links as well, podcasts and so on and so forth. So yeah, that's it.
Okay, great. And you're, just to remind people, you are a coach at Stronger by Science, and you're also involved in the RAPS Research Review, which is under Lane Norton, so people can check that out as well.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for being on the show.